Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. Today is Thursday, and we are in the Shelbourne Hotel in Dublin, Ireland, on a very special day for our guest. First of all, let me welcome Dr. John Leahy, who is the president of Quinnipiac University and has been for what is now almost a quarter of a century. John, does that have a ring to it in terms of that's...
It's been 27 years, actually. This is my 27th year.
27?
I started in March of 87, so it's a long tenure. It's been a great ride, and hopefully I got some more years left ahead of me.
There's, of course, many of our listeners would know that you are the creator and the founder of Ireland's Great Hunger Museum in Hamden, Connecticut. But I want to talk a little bit about today in Ireland, a very special day when the President of Ireland, Michael D. Higgins, and the Taoiseach, Prime Minister of Ireland, Andy Kenny, greeted you, recognized you, and honored you very specifically for your role, not only in the establishment of Ireland's Great Hunger Museum, but rather for the 16 years, because you were the person who really brought to the fore the topic of Ireland's Great Hunger, of the famine. You used a very special occasion, the St. Patrick's Day Parade. You were Grand Marshal, elected Grand Marshal of the St. Patrick's Day Parade. And you used that occasion to roll out a theme that many perhaps would have thought there was nothing sexy about rolling out Ireland's famine, Ireland's great tragedy. But you choose then to use that and to create that thing. Can you bring us back to 1997?
I can. I remember being on your show after the parade. You asked me almost the same question as to why I didn't do as most of my predecessor Grand Marshals and simply talk about my life and my ancestors and what Ireland means to them.
St. Patrick and the Catholic Church.
Exactly. I guess it's the educator in me. I don't take these honors or recognitions personally, really, and I have no doubt that I was selected Grand Marshal not because I was Herb and Caroline Leahy's son, but more because I was the president of Quinnipiac University. And so, the educator in me, I felt it was important to use the platform that you're given as Grand Marshal to not talk about yourself, but to try to educate people about something important. And it was just so happened that that year was a lot was going on both sides of the Atlantic. It was the 150th anniversary of the Great Hunger. Interestingly, the 100th anniversary, there was almost nothing done in either side. It was still too painful an event back in 1947. So it's amazing. It took 150 years for the Irish, both in Ireland and in America and elsewhere, to talk about and think about the Great Hunger and what it meant to them. And so in any event, I felt it was important to use my platform. And as I think I told you also, leading the parade up Fifth Avenue on March 17th is the easy job, the easy part of the job for the Grand Marshal. The more important one is that from January 1 to March 17th, you're invited to about 200 Irish events in New York and all the annual county parties and Hibernian events and so on. So you needed to give a speech. And so I used those opportunities to talk about the Great Hunger. And so I didn't, while it was, you're right, challenging or controversial at the time, and the British government actually was critical of Governor Pataki and some others who were active in terms of supporting the Great Hunger as part of the curriculum in our high schools in New York, I felt it was important to do it. I must admit, I thought when it was finished that day, after you interviewed me on your show at the end of the parade, I thought that was pretty much the end of it. But
and normally it is.
Absolutely. And it was just fortunate that a member of our Board of Trustees, Murray Lender, whose parents fled Poland, Jewish immigrants came to the country to avoid persecution under the Nazis. And he heard those speeches I gave and attended actually the parade on that day. And after it, he told me, he said, look, John, I'm going to give you a gift for this library that you've solicited a gift from me for, but I want it to go to a special room dedicated to the Great Hunger so that the education that you just started with the parade can continue on for years into the future. And he actually, more than we as Irish, I think, saw the compelling nature of the Great Hunger story and the need to tell it. So I always, we lost Murray just a little over a year and a half ago, but as I said at the dedication of the museum last year, while a lot of Irish and Irish Americans contributed to making this possible, if it were not for the son of Polish Jewish immigrants who really saw the compelling nature, we wouldn't have this museum on Guttermore here today. So it did all relate to that time, but I can't say I had this grand idea. I'd become Grand Marshal, and I talk about the Great Hunger, and then 15 years later we'd end up with a museum on Guttermore. Things happen in life, and we were just took advantage, I guess, of the opportunity, and I'm very proud and pleased. Particularly, this is the first time I've been on Irish soil to talk about it today. It's really the first anniversary of the opening of the
right.
So these meetings today with the Taoiseach and the President of Ireland are very special days that I'm sure I'll remember for the rest of my life.
Can you talk about the interim? Murray Lender, of great fame within the community, might have wondered, and we should point out also that Murray Lender is of the famous Lender Bagel empire. But between shortly after that, tell us about the library, the collection, the artifacts, which. And how did that collection, not only take place, but the collection itself through what would then be 15 years?
Well, Murray, as I said, I was soliciting a gift for the library just a few weeks after the parade had ended, and I was looking for just a gift in general from him, and that's it was really his response to it. He said, "Look, John, I'll give you something for the library, and I'll get my brother Marvin to match the gift, but I want it to go to the Great Hunger." And so after some conversation, we decided the best thing to do was to have a special collection room, which you very often have in libraries
right.
and university campuses. So we decided we'd have a special collection room, and as I sat down and talked with him, we would need to acquire some rare books and educational materials and research materials on the Great Hunger, as well as some artwork that would go in that room. I felt strongly that the visual arts are both underappreciated in Ireland and really were so negatively impacted by the Great Hunger. And I always think, art is a kind of universal language. It's like music. It transcends language, and you can look at it, and you don't have to know even what the Great Hunger or Guttermore means, and you can see through art. It's a great way of telling a story, and particularly this a painful story like the Great Hunger. So I was keen on doing the artwork. In any event, he didn't quite give me a blank check, but he gave me a very large check and got his brother to match it. And he said, "John, you go ahead and find the artwork and the educational materials." And then 2 years, 3 years later, in 2000. September 2000, we dedicated the building and the room there, which still remains today,
right.
is the Murray Lender on Guttermore Irish Special Collection room. But he and his brother, even after we did that, continued to support the collection. So it really has been a 15-year journey from when he gave me the first check, and I came over to Ireland here in the summer of 97, and I acquired my first little piece, Rowan Gillespie, whom I was talking with last night at the reception, and the victim. And I literally carried that sculpture back in my arms on my Aer Lingus flight going back. But then over the last 15 years...
Were you surprised, John Leahy, that we might have assumed that there was a glut of artifacts, that had to be somewhere, and there wasn't?
No, that's right. One of the things I've learned during this 15-year period, and again, it relates directly to the famine and the Great Hunger, there was almost no art produced during the time of the famine. And not surprisingly, back then you had to be sponsored in terms of your artwork, and most of the wealthy people were English or Anglo-Irish,
right.
And they certainly didn't want to commission starving Irish peasants and skeletons and deaths and to be hanging on their walls, reminding them that contrary to what many of the history books of the time said, that they bore some significant responsibility for the great hunger. So you had almost no art produced. And then, as I said, even 100 years later, in 1947, 100th anniversary of Black 47, the Irish government and American governments and Australia and others produced no art. There was almost no ceremonies remembering 100-year anniversary of the Great Hunger. And it was not until 1997, the 150th anniversary, that thankfully Ireland, both economically and politically, and I think literally in terms of its psyche, was elevated sufficiently and had a degree of self-confidence that they could look back on this period.
Right.
And the Irish government commissioned a number of pieces of art, as you know, mm-hmm. and your beloved Mayo and Kilpatrick, the famine ship that's there, and here on the Custom House Quay, Rowan Gillespie's famine.
Right.
Family, and so there were a number of pieces that were just commissioned. That was really just the beginning of Irish artists actually having subject matter of the famine as part of their artwork. And so we actually, in a relatively short period of time during those 15 years, acquired what turned out to be now clearly the largest collection of famine-related art anywhere in the world. And that led to this small room, relatively small room in our library being inadequate to house. And also it was in the middle of our campus, so it wasn't as accessible to the public. And continuing Murray's and my plans of educating more and more people, we ultimately saw the need to build an entire building on Whitney Avenue right near our campus, but something much more accessible to the general public. And we've had over 10,000 people have already visited that museum in the last, in the last year, not quite a year yet. So it's very gratifying for me to look back over what's happened over the past 15 years. And as I said, this is the first time I've had the opportunity of being on Irish soil to sort of celebrate it. And it was just wonderful last night being with some of the artists here and there in their beloved Ireland, and to meet the Taoiseach and the President here today.
Many of the artists were not already developing art relating to the famine. They had to be commissioned to that. Mm. Again, many of them were not known for any of their, for their artwork relating to the famine, and in fact had no good reason to go there. Mm. The interest level would have to come and be nurtured. Right. And as the President and as the Taoiseach, in recognizing you today, I think there was in addition to the work you have done, that it would bear enough in hindsight that, you brought the topic up in the first place, that you rolled it out at a time when there was tremendous opposition. Mm-hmm. And even those who felt maybe, John Leahy is a good idea. However, we have sensitive issues in the north of Ireland. This is not a good time to, be alienating the Brits. There's such sensitivity. And this did not go unnoticed by you. But I think in hindsight, many would say, well, there was never going to be a good time. It wasn't going to be, after the Good Friday Agreement. It wasn't going to be after anything.
Right. No, you're right, and it's interesting. When I was Grand Marshal back in 1997, and literally the first speech I made about the Great Hunger after my announcement, there was a highly critical comment coming from the British government representative mm-hmm. in D.C. We've dedicated this museum now, just October of this past year in 2013. It's been open for a full year. There has not been a single negative comment about the Great Hunger, the museum, the messages that we've sent, which tells you something has happened in the last 15 years that is a very
yes.
positive development. And, of course, in 1997, Tony Blair did make his comment, which mm-hmm. I thought was certainly the closest thing to an apology that any Prime Minister of England
right.
has made since the parade. I know some thought it wasn't as complete and full an apology, but I thought it was a very important statement. And I think certainly the Good Friday Agreement and other positive developments have made it such that even the British now are acknowledging the tragedy of the Great Hunger and their responsibility to some degree. And going back to the artists, you're right. Not only were they not encouraged, it would have been the kiss of death 10 or 15, 20 years ago or 25 years ago for any of these artists in Ireland who were first-rate artists to have the famine be the content. They really, in fact, to be a great artist in Ireland, up until quite recently, you wanted international recognition and you didn't want those things. So we really gave an opportunity for some of these artists, the John Behan's and the Rowan Gillespie. Rowan told me, you know, even though he was commissioned to do the famine piece down at the Custom House Quay just during the 1997 period, his father never visited that sculpture that was produced there. His father told him, and in fact, his father told him, tried to talk him out of doing it. He did not think it was the proper content for artwork to be remembering the Great Hunger. And I'm sure Rowan saddened that his dad didn't see this great work that the literally the government of Ireland commissioned. And so you're right, it was the kiss of death, really, for an Irish artist who wanted fame and wanted recognition to even do anything on the famine. And certainly the last 15 years, you know, it's been very gratifying to me and that we, in maybe some small way, have allowed artists in Ireland now to produce the visual arts about the famine and yet have it advance their careers and certainly not be something that would hold them back in terms of their international recognition. So that's a huge sea change. And again, you know, only a 15-year period of time. That certainly would not have happened. If the museum had been dedicated 15 years ago, I think there would be enormous amount of criticism and attacks. And you know, things are improving. There's a long way to go, but I think I'm very pleased with the very positive effect that the museum has had.
Many historians, of course, had written about the famine, and many, you know, had spoken about the famine, you know, in you know, past tense, way past tense. One historian in particular brought it forth to today, and that was Christine Keneally. Mm-hmm. What was it about her writing which captured your attention?
Well, I think, and she was the biggest influence on me, and had some more than a little to do with my having The Great Hunger be the theme of the parade that year. I had just read the book, I think, the prior year. It had just been published, I think, on this side of the Atlantic in 95. Mm-hmm. I think it was over in America in 96 that I read it. What she did, she was my really intellectual awakening. You know, I grew up in Riverdale in an Irish neighborhood, and the famine was really not discussed. But the extent to which it was, you know, it was basically, you know, we believe what historians of the times, the Anglo historians, said, that, you know, it was at least partly our fault that we became dependent on the potato, and so we bore some responsibility. And it wasn't until I read Christine's book that I really appreciated the extent to which clearly there was this potato crop failure that occurred during that period. Certainly would have led to some deaths, but it did not have to become the great calamity that it became, that those decisions were made by the British government, who were in total control of Ireland during that period. They made decisions not to keep the tariffs where they were, so it was too expensive to allow exports of food. And as the other thing about Christine's book, she documented painstaking detail. She's a great 19th century historian. She had literally the records from the ships documenting the amount of food shipped out of Ireland. The potato crop failed, but the amount of food that was in Ireland, livestock and vegetables and butter and eggs and bacon, literally the details of food shipped right past the starving mouths of men, women, and children in Ireland during that period. It was just, to me, it brought out the true impact of that catastrophe and the human responsibility on the part of the British government for having done it. That's what, and here she did it not in a way that was just theory, but all she did, really, I don't think she did any kind of spin or any kind of personal theorizing. You just read the documents and see the actual exports of food out of, from Ireland to England during that period, and it was just a compelling story that no amount of earlier writing of history could change. So, and then the other thing that in reading that, when you realize it, you realize how not only did the British have responsibility for the Great Hunger, but they also very consciously, through history and literature and through the lack of art and other things, and through people like Erskine Nicol, who painted and depicted the Irish as in the worst caricatures, over 150 years, they made sure that the true story of the Great Hunger was not told. Indeed, that it was very inaccurately told, much as I learned when I was a boy growing up in Riverdale in the Bronx, you know, that it was our responsibility. It was our fault we became dependent on potatoes. It was our fault that that we were, couldn't take care of ourselves during that period of time, and so on. So the combination of the really historical facts that showed the British responsibility, and then almost 150 years of rewriting history so that the people believed the British version of it, which obviously eliminated to a large extent any culpability or responsibility, and therefore, and that part in a way made me angry that occurred. Yeah. You see the power of art and history, and history books are written by the victors, and in this case not only did the famine occur, but England ruled Ireland for another 75 years in total, and to this day from the six counties of Northern Ireland. So they very much wrote the history books to distort the story. So that's why, again, as the educator, it's not only that we're going to report about the Great Hunger, we need to re-educate people about, so that they don't believe the myths and the untruths that were perpetrated and recorded as if they were objective history by the British government for the better part of 150 years.
Those of us who were born in Ireland and who grew up in in many of the famine areas, myself being from Attymass, which was the first parish to report death from starvation. Many of us, and definitely the generation before us, would have felt some sort of a strange sense of shame, however unjustified, because we were the survivors. Mm-hmm. And as such, a quiet prayer would probably have been the best way. Now, I just want to take that and bring it back to your Riverdale. Mm-hmm. I'm sure there must have been many in Riverdale who said, Jesus, John Lee could be doing something else. Mm-hmm. I mean, do we really need to have this story told now?
Well, obviously, the 150th anniversary was an opportunity to do it, but you're right. I've said on a number of occasions, the outside of Ireland, the best place for this museum on Gorton Moor to be is where it is in Hamden, Connecticut, midway between Boston and New York, the two great cities that benefited from it. Someday, I hope there will be a museum very similar to this in Ireland, and we certainly plan to bring the artwork here and to have exhibits in Ireland. But I think it does speak to the tragedy was even more painful for the reasons you've mentioned, almost a victim's mentality, whether you died or survived, the guilt associated with it. I think it's still too painful for the Irish in Ireland to do that.
Yes.
The benefits that we have as Irish Americans is we can balance off the negative aspect of the famine with the fact that, in my case, my grandfather, as a boy, left Ireland in 1876, came to New York, and as with many other Irish during the post-famine period, they came here and started at the bottom and certainly faced their own discrimination here in an Anglo-Protestant-dominated society. But they survived, and they progressed, and they contributed to this country like no other ethnic group or racial group has, in terms of building the railroads and the schools and the Catholic Church and then moving into politics and the labor unions and corporate America ultimately. So I think it's a little easier for us as Irish Americans because we have that positive aspect to look back on the famine and recognize what it is, this painful event in our history. And so, as I said, I think someday I hope there's a museum on Gorton Moor like this one. I mean, there's something in Strokestown, and there's different pieces of art here and there. but there's nothing like what we have in Hamden, Connecticut, a museum dedicated just to this topic, educating people, having the artwork and the visual representation. So I do hope someday it will be here in Ireland, but I can understand and appreciate why those of you, you know, who were born in Ireland and for whom they had to. The other part was the immigration.
Sure.
And this Murray Linder, very much appreciated this. You know, it wasn't just, most people say, well, he was Jewish, so he preached the Holocaust, and he understood suffering and genocide and all the rest. It was also the immigrant experience. He well knew what his parents had to do. It wasn't just that, obviously, his parents survived. They weren't killed by the Nazis. But he understood what it meant for a family to pick up everything. You know, they only speak Polish, their family, their friends, to leave a country, come to a foreign country where they didn't speak the language, to start over again. He knew how challenging the immigrant story is, and it's not just Polish. The Irish did the same thing, and I think he appreciated how, you know, they left their beloved country, came here, started from the bottom, and had to survive and progress. And so I think he really identified not just with the death and suffering of the famine, and with some similar aspects to the Holocaust, but I think he also appreciated what it meant for families to have to separate and leave their native country and go to another country and start at the bottom all over again and learn the language and the customs and assimilate eventually. And so I think that's why, as I said, I think Americans and the diaspora find it a little easier to talk about the famine the way we have, and why even 150 plus years now later, 165 years I guess now, it's still pretty painful. But I must say, based on last night's reception, you know, academics, they're not only Christine, honored to say, has just joined the Quinnipiac faculty and will be developing an Irish studies program for us, and is going to head up an academic Great Hunger Institute at Quinnipiac. So there's a lot of activity on both sides of the Atlantic now in with respect to the Great Hunger and the famine. And so I think Ireland and the Irish in Ireland will be facing it and dealing with it in visual arts and history and culture. And as I say, I'm sure there'll be a day in the future where there'll be a museum on Cottermore similar to ours right here in Dublin, no doubt.
Can I ask you just to expand a little bit on the Irish Studies program? Mm-hmm. And what is the theme, and how is that different from, you know, many of the universities throughout?
Well, certainly we will be taking advantage of the fact that we have already significant research and educational materials and a museum dedicated to the Great Hunger. And the thing about the famine, or the Great Hunger, as we more commonly call it now, it's so pivotal in Irish history. I mean, whether it's a description of why we didn't have art during that period, and why at least we have begun to have some of it, or the history, or the immigration. I mean, it all.
Right.
Everyone can tie back to that event. You know, the economic development of Ireland. It, you know, basically, it almost eliminated the Industrial Revolution in Ireland. They almost went from an agricultural society to a high-tech society today. So that resource certainly will make our program unique. We will have more courses on the Great Hunger, and it will be of an interdisciplinary nature. The rest of it, I think, will be typical, similar to what a Boston College or a Notre Dame would have. We plan to have a full range of courses on Irish history and Irish culture and Irish language. And we also will be meeting on Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, with Philip Nolan, the president, who was at our reception last night, the president of Maynooth, and his people there. And we're going to develop this program in conjunction, we hope, with Maynooth.
Right.
And what I would envision is our students in the program will spend a semester or a full year here in Ireland studying at Maynooth. So it'll be maybe 3 years in the United States and a full year here in Maynooth. I see some of their faculty teaching some of the courses on our campus in the United States, and potentially a Christine Keneally or some others teaching over here. So I hope it's a very much an integrated program. And, you know, there are a lot of places that start an Irish Studies program, but for me, if you're going to have a serious Irish Studies program, you need to do it in conjunction with an Irish university. And Maynooth is a great university. We have relations already with Galway and Cork and Trinity College with our law program. But Maynooth is our size, and it's dedicated to to teaching. You know, it's only a half hour outside of Dublin, and but yet it's a beautiful campus. So there are a lot of similarities between the mission of Quinnipiac University and the mission of National University of Ireland. And so I think this is a great combination. And while we haven't worked all the details out, we'll begin right. doing some of that on this coming Tuesday, I think it will be a great partnership that will allow our Irish Studies program not only to be as good as the Notre Dame's and the Boston College, but I think with the special resource and asset that we have about the Great Hunger, I think it will even be a more unique and a different program than the rest of them.
When you took over as president of Quinnipiac University, relatively, it would actually have been listed as one of the smaller universities. And, you know, 27 years forward, this is now a massive university and indeed has been listed in the top 25 universities throughout the United States. Mm. That building, that, you know, transition from that, how did that occur? How did that happen?
Well, it wasn't overnight, but it was you know, like anything else, you need a vision as to what you'd like to do with any organization. In this case, a university. We were 1,902 students when I came in March of '87. We had a 100-acre campus. We were about 80% of the students were local students from Connecticut, commuting, and very few outside of it. And we had a College of Business, which was our origin. We had a College of Health and a College of Liberal Arts. Those were our three schools. And again, you're absolutely right. It was a college. It was Quinnipiac College then. But I really wanted to have it be a much larger university. I wanted it to be larger. I wanted it to be better. I wanted it to be better recognized. And so to do all those things. You know, we laid out a strategic plan and decided to grow the university. Today, we're now 9,000 undergraduate and graduate students, about 6,500 full-time undergraduates, 2,500 graduate students. We've most recently added a new engineering school that we just admitted our first class. We just opened a new medical school that we admitted our first class. So over the next 5 years, we'll add 500 undergraduates with engineering. We'll add 500 graduate students at the medical school. So we'll be 10,000 students in the next 4 or 5 years. But we grew from, you know, 1,902 to do that. We had to add dormitories to attract students from outside of Connecticut. Back then in 1987, we were 80% Connecticut residents. Just the reverse today, 80% of our students from outside of Connecticut. We started a little something called the Quinnipiac University Poll that now is nationally and internationally renowned. I can remember, this is a little known sort of part of our history, but when I started the poll, and if you were to look at the poll and where I moved it from, I started in Connecticut. We did statewide polls in Connecticut. Then we moved it to New York and did statewide polls in New York. Then we went to New Jersey, did statewide polls in New York. Then we moved to Pennsylvania, did statewide. Then we moved to Ohio, and then we did Virginia. Then we moved it to Florida, where, if you know Florida, the southern half is like the northeast, and so you get the grandparents and the you could trace the applications for Quinnipiac during that 15-20 year period when we were developing the poll. You could see the growth in applications from Connecticut to New York to New Jersey to Pennsylvania to Ohio to Virginia, and now in some cases we've gone national. So that was an important part. We developed our athletic programs to be nationally recognized. You have to go Division I athletics, so we moved our programs up. Our hockey team, we joined the ECAC, arguably one of the best academic and athletic conferences in the country, playing Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Brown, Cornell. We were fortunate enough this past year. We played in the national championship in Pittsburgh against Yale. And you know, we did obviously some public relations and advertising, and developed our board and developed our alumni association, and certainly the activity with the St. Patrick's Day Parade and the Great Hunger Museum
gave us a tremendous
amount of visibility. So today, you know, we changed the name along the line. We acquired a law school from Bridgeport during that period. We took a small communications program. Now it's a school with 1,500 students. So, as I said, it was I can't tell you. I had everything in mind 25 years ago, 27 years ago, but I knew it was going to grow and develop, and I knew the pieces of it. And so, you know, everything starts with a vision, and then you need good people to help you implement and execute on that plan.
After this 27 years, what is your own reaction to those, you know, who say, Quinnipiac, oh yeah, that's the polling place, isn't it? And in fact, you know, got to know Quinnipiac and got to rely on what is now considered to be the most accurate.
Yeah. Well, you know, I know a little bit about marketing overall. I mean, you have to get known. You don't get known for everything. Harvard didn't become Harvard University because they were known in everything. They focused on the medical school and their business school in particular and developed those. And that sort of gives a halo effect over you. So you have to get known. The polling institute, when we started that, frankly, people in New York couldn't pronounce Quinnipiac back then.
Right.
So the poll helped actually with the radio and people pronouncing it. And we still work, still a challenging name to do. But so that helped. We, you know, the medical school that we just added, we're the 141st U.S. medical school. In the country. We have a law school. There are only 200 ABA-accredited law schools in the country. There are only 98 universities. There's almost 4,000 universities in America, only 98 that have both a medical school and a law school. Back in 1986, we got maybe 1,000 applications for 800 seats. This past year, we just received 22,000 applications for the 1,800 seats in our freshman class. Our medical school, we just enrolled 60 students this past year. We got 2,000 applications from all over the country. For next year's class, which will only be 90 slots in America, we already have over 4,000 applications for that. So, you know, I was kidding our hockey program. I said, you know, the poll got a lot of recognition for the Quinnipiac University. I said, but it took me 25 years. I said, you know, this hockey program, I said, in one weekend playing for a national championship probably got us better recognition. And I'll tell you a funny story with the poll. You're absolutely right what it did for us. We just started polling in Colorado. We're adding a couple more states
right.
for leading up to the new presidential election that's coming up. Colorado is one of them. Anyway, our people went out there from the poll to meet with the media people out in Colorado, let them know what we were doing and so on. And they say, oh, Quinnipiac. We know Quinnipiac. Hockey. So you never know. Colorado's a big hockey state, and Denver in particular. So, you know, you now add the poll maybe was the first thing to get our name out there.
Right.
The athletic program, and in particular hockey, certainly helped. And I would say the medical school has added tremendous prestige in the academic community and the general. So I'm pleased that maybe, you know, the poll is a research and educational
right.
Program. Athletics are also obviously a big way that Notre Dame and the others became nationally known. And now medical school. I think that's a pretty good combination. If you're known nationally for being the greatest polling operation, if you're known for something in athletics like the hockey program we have, and now a medical school. And I think, again, that has a halo effect over when you have
right.
that many good things going on, people assume correctly your business school is first rate, your law school is first rate, your communications program is first rate. And I predict with this Irish Studies program that we're developing, I think people will correctly assume that our Irish Studies will be a first-rate program. So, you know, you can't just get out there and talk to people about everything. You have to get known for a couple of things from a marketing point of view. And I think, you know, that's worked very well. And I certainly, the poll is near and dear to me. I'm a kind of a political junkie in any event. But I think it was maybe the first thing that got us known nationally.
Right.
But as people learn, obviously, you get 22,000 applications now for your freshman class. They're not applying because Quinnipiac has a poll. But it may be that maybe their parents or the grandparents
yes.
first heard about Quinnipiac through the poll, and then it piqued their interest, and they came and looked. And I was interested. I talked to the academic director of the Notre Dame program last night, and he was aware of the poll, but he was also aware of what we did with the Great Hunger. And he said, you know, he says, the first time I've met you, and he said, but my sense is Quinnipiac University, whatever they do it very, very well. And he said, and that's my impression over here in Ireland. So I think that is our philosophy, and thankfully the poll was maybe the first thing to get people's attention, but I think there are other things now.
How do you react to those of us, you know, who say, you know, that damn Quinnipiac poll influences, you know, a vote. We, you know, and we saw, while other polls were fairly general, that Quinnipiac had pinpointed.
Mm.
the Quinnipiac poll as something which definitely did not work out in our favor, those of us who thought that it was a given that Christine Quinn was going to be the next mayor of New York. Now, how, what's your own reaction to that?
You know, that's I'm not an expert pollster, but I know the literature on this topic as to whether polls influence or whatever. I don't think there's much support for that. I think they're an accurate reflection of trends, and I must say I like Christine. I know her well, and I think she ran a great general election campaign as being kind of a moderate or pro-business, and maybe she forgot that she had to win the nomination, that she was in a Democratic primary, and I think, you know, a couple issues, the stop and frisk became the main issue there. I don't think anyone saw that coming, and de Blasio, to his credit, I guess, jumped on it early, and I think Bill Thompson and Christine Quinn were more moderate on that issue, and apparently within the Democratic primary, as often happens, you know, this was a primary. It's, you know, for us, we think the election's over, and it probably is, because New York is such a Democratic city. But in the Democratic primaries, in particular, you know, the rank and file, the activists in the party tend to be the much more liberal and more extreme. And de Blasio, to his credit, really out of nowhere. I mean, Christine was ahead 20 points in our poll a year or two ago, and she just, as that issue in particular caught on. So, yeah, I don't think we reflected it. I think that was clearly an issue-driven campaign that I think surprised a lot of us. And certainly a year ago, you wouldn't have gotten a bet on de Blasio, and you would have gotten a lot of bets on Christine. So I'm glad she's still in city government and,
absolutely,
and president, and I think very highly of her, and it would have been great to have her.
The museum, on this, the first anniversary of the museum, tell us about the curator. Tell us about this structure now. It was there, it has been opened, it has been so internationally reviewed and acknowledged as the only one of its type outside of Ireland.
Right.
How do you then select who's going to run it? How do you continue to collect the art, to make...
Yeah, we have a board structure now. This actually, the museum, while it's part of Quinnipiac University, has it's actually separately incorporated for people who want to give gifts, who might want to give gifts to a museum as opposed and not necessarily to a university. So we have a separate board. I'm the chairman of the board, so I'm very much staying involved with it. We had one of our board meetings here yesterday, and we have an executive director, Grace Brady, that we hired, who comes out of the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and.
She's not a bad place to start.
No, and we intentionally, while this is going to be something that has Irish art and tells the story of the Great Hungry, I also very much want it to be a museum that's respected on its own for the quality of its art. So that was one of the reasons. She was really not, while she has some Irish roots, she's not an Irish history historian or Irish art specialist, but she knows how to make this museum a first-rate museum. So Grace is very important. Obviously, she's on the board. But we selected Neve O'Sullivan, who is very well known here in Ireland, was a longtime professor at the College of Arts, Visual Arts, and here in Dublin, and associated with the Museum of Modern Art here in Ireland. She's our curator. She's on board, and she's under contract. She works for Quinnipiac. She still lives in Ireland, but she is the person now, before we purchase a new piece of art, Neve has to pass Neve's judgment as and to do that it has to have museum quality to be an art. Its content has to be at least related, or at least it has to be contextually related and give a context to the art, which much of the 19th century art we're currently acquiring. The rest of the board are internal Quinnipiac people. Pat Healy, our chief financial officer, Gene Husted, our vice president, my assistant, Lynn Bushnell, our vice president for public affairs. And then we just added, to get the academic component, the dean of our College of Arts and Sciences, Hans Bergman, and Christine Keneally, who's just been appointed professor of Irish history, Irish studies at Quinnipiac. And she's going to have an institute for a Great Hunger Institute as part of an academic mission that will sponsor conferences, do publications, and other things. We've added her to the board to make sure that the academic piece and the museum piece work hand in glove together. And so that constitutes the board. I think there are seven of us now, and we meet quarterly. We make decisions in terms of budgets, and all future acquisitions have to be approved. We spent a better part of an hour looking at different artworks. We were here for Adams One of the reasons we timed this on this time of the year at the end of September, the Adams had their auction 2 days ago. White's having their auction on Monday night, I believe it is, and we were with the Gorey Gallery people yesterday, and so we're in the business of acquiring additional artwork for this museum, not only acquiring future pieces of art that deal with the famine as content, but also adding higher and higher quality, museum quality art to it. So you will see the museum continue to grow and develop, and I thought it was important that our curator be someone here in Ireland, and no one is better connected and well-known and respected in the art world here in Ireland than Evel Sullivan. So so she has a very important role. She doesn't make the final say, but if it doesn't get by Neve, it doesn't get to the board for a vote, and then ultimately the board votes on it. So, and we're serious art people. We're looking at, we know we have some holes in the collection that we need, and we have our eyes set on things, and I would say in the future, we have more than enough art to fill the museum now. I think you'll see us, as we make announcements in the future, we will be purchasing fewer pieces of art, but better pieces of art. The rag pickers by Henry Allen that we just acquired was a piece that was very much on our radar that we wanted to, and by some different artists that we don't possess now. So we're very serious about making sure that the art that's purchase in the future both relates to the famine, helps us to tell the story of the Great Hunger, but also continues to upgrade the quality of the art so that this museum in the future will be respected in the museum world, in the art world, separate and apart from what the content and the educational mission of the museum is.
John Leahy, lest anybody think he is relaxing in Ireland, is currently and at this moment being shuffled by his handlers, who are giving me dirty looks. Thank you for taking this time with us, John Leahy. And we're delighted, and happy anniversary.
Great. Well, thanks, Adrian. As I said, you interviewed me back in 97. It's wonderful to be with you again. I appreciate all the great work you do for all the Irish, but particularly the Irish in America.
Friends from Dublin, Ireland, Dr. John Leahy, president of Quinnipiac University, and indeed founder of Ireland's Great Hunger Museum in Hamden, Connecticut.